evident that the American people may come to consider it their patriotic duty to not follow the avoidance schemes and play the game by the rules, something our current system certainly doesn't encourage. Okay, next criticism. The consumption tax base is more volatile and less reliable than our current income tax base. Two questions have been raised on this topic. First, would we be able to maintain a broad enough consumption tax base to fund essential government services if Congress started monkeying around with exemptions and exceptions? Second, even without such congressional tinkering, would the consumption base remain sufficient to fund government services during economic downturns? There are several ways to take on the first question. To begin with, it would make sense to compare the breadth of the consumption base with the current income tax base. The figures will show that it should be easy to improve on the current system. Under our current income tax system, the top 1% of all income earners actually earn about 19% of the income. They pay well over one-third of all of the taxes. The top 5% of income earners claim about one-third of all income, yet they pay about 57% of all income taxes collected by the federal government. Now for the bottom half. This group earns about 13% of the income, pays together just over 3% of all income taxes. Looking at these figures, does it seem evident that we've about exhausted the income base in this country when it comes to taxation? In our political climate, few politicians would dare try to increase the share of taxes paid by those in the bottom half of income earners. Given that, how much more do they think they can burden the high achievers without throwing the whole system into political and economic turmoil? That's half the story, currying voters' favor by pushing taxes to fewer and fewer taxpayers. The other half involves reordering the tax burden by exempting or crediting certain purchases or behaviors. The Bureau of Economic Analysis tells us that Americans made about $10.3 trillion in personal income in 2005. The IRS tells us that the total adjusted gross income on 2005 individual tax returns was only $7.2 trillion. Looks like some money's missing, doesn't it? We've lost 30% of the personal income tax base right there. But there's more. Modified taxable income in 2005, that's total taxable income minus all deductions and exemptions, was only $5.1 trillion. A quick calculation will reveal that the modified taxable income in this country in 2005 came to less than half the total personal income for that year. Consider this while you sit there worrying about the erosion of the consumption tax base after enactment of the fair tax. It's clear that our income tax base has already been eroded drastically. It's true that the above-referenced mess of an income tax system was made dysfunctional by congressional action. For example, the last major effort to simplify the income tax system was passed in 1986. Succeeding Congresses have amended that 16,000 times in the last 20 years. But it's equally true that future Congresses could work the same dark magic on the fair tax by seeking to curry favor by exempting this item or that item from the fair tax. For that reason, we're going to try to impose a super majority requirement before Congress can exclude or exempt any good or service from the fair tax. But your role will be crucial in ensuring that the fair tax isn't gutted by Washington. Income tax increases are typically sold to the public by promising that they will only affect the top 2% of income earners. That always wins at the polls. The fair tax will impact everyone equally. Any exemptions would end up raising the fair tax rate for everybody. So we'll count on you to withhold your vote from politicians who demonstrate a willingness to tamper with this very delicate system by exempting items whose purchasers happen to have the clout to pay for a lobbyist in Washington. Back to the numbers. In 2005, total personal consumption exceeded personal taxable income by more than 70%. Total personal consumption was $8.7 trillion. Taxable income, $5.1 trillion. Seems as though the larger base would be safer from erosion than the smaller one, doesn't it? You'd think that a larger base, a base that touches everyone equally, would be less likely to pick winners and losers, wouldn't you? The Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman thought so when asked by the President's Advisory Panel for Federal Tax Reform what kind of tax base would be best protected from erosion. He said, "It seems to me that if you have a system in which there are no exemptions and no special deductions, it would be most likely to stay the same from year to year and not have the interventions." Sounds like a certain tax system we're talking about right now, doesn't it? Additionally, for decades, the consumption base has remained much more predictable in good times and bad than the income base has. The legislative changes occurring constantly at the state and federal level make it difficult to look at raw tax revenues and determine if they rose or fell based on economic conditions or legislative changes. To make our point about the stability of the consumption base, we turn to the Rockefeller Institute of Government, the public policy research arm of the State University of New York, which has spent years analyzing changes in state revenues across the nation. A chart in the actual book, The Fair Tax, The Truth, based on that analysis, reflects and shows the changes in state revenues and percentage points from the previous quarter. The Rockefeller Institute has gone so far as to adjust these numbers to eliminate the effect of legislative changes in tax rates and or exemptions affecting the tax base and so on. The chart reflects exclusively economic conditions, which is exactly what we want to measure. Now, you don't have the chart in front of you, but I'll just say this. Look at the line reflecting sales tax. While the personal income tax is spiking regularly, the sales tax line is much more stable. But what about the giant collapse? You'll see a collapse when you look at the chart. You're absolutely right. Those are the quarters following 9/11. While Americans' income was drastically affected, you can see that their consumption, while still affected, remained relatively stable. Why? Because consumption comes from three sources: income, savings, and borrowing. Stating the obvious, income only comes from income. The point here is, fair tax opponents will tell you that the consumption base, the base for the national sales tax, isn't stable and can't be trusted. But this chart will show you, and in reality, it's the income tax base that's unstable and can't be trusted. The consumption base is much more predictable. And remember, when we talk about the value of stability, we're not just talking about preventing tax revenues from falling unexpectedly. The prospect of tax revenues rising unexpectedly may even be more distressing. Do you remember the last time the federal government brought in more money than it expected? Well, it happened many times over the last 20 years. Do you remember getting a special refund? I don't think so. On the contrary, if you watch the debate in Congress, you saw member after member take to the floor and demand more money for his or her favorite program from the surplus that was coming in. To paraphrase a famous movie, if you send it, they will spend it. Now there's more. It appears that in addition to greater tax-based stability, states that have no personal income tax and rely on the sales tax have faster growing economies than income tax states. If that isn't a selling point for the fair tax, we can't imagine what is. Personal income, population, and jobs all grew faster in the 9 states with no income tax than in the 9 states with the highest personal income tax rates. We know how much you like charts and graphs. That's probably why you're reading or listening to the audio version, so you don't have to deal with charts and graphs. But if you have the book, go ahead and spend a little time with that chart, talking about the states with and without personal income tax rates. Just more evidence of the economic advantages of a consumption tax over an income tax. Is this sinking in yet? Are there disadvantages? Yeah, maybe one. It makes politicians less powerful. The next criticism: the only way to keep the fair tax rate low is to tax services. But experience shows that state sales taxes on services haven't worked. When given a speech in Washington, D.C. on the fair tax a couple of years ago to a group of doctors from California, Congressman Linder was taken by the positive response of the doctors. They applauded. They cheered. Then one lady got a startled look on her face, and she jumped out of her seat, and she said, "You expect me to tax my patients?" Congressman Linder said, "What makes you think you're so special? All your neighbors tax the source of their income to support the state. Why shouldn't you?" She never got over that exchange, but her colleagues did. Doctors, like most service providers, understand how much of their cost are labor cost and how much they pay in payroll taxes on behalf of their employees. And from there, it's just a short leap for them to realize how much their cost of equipment are inflated by the embedded cost of the current tax system. With a little explanation, most of them come to recognize they're taxing their patients already. The only difference between the current system and the fair tax is that the tax they currently levy on their patients is embedded. It's hidden in their fees. With the fair tax, those taxes will be clearly delineated as a part of the fee they charge. The cost to the patients remains essentially the same. Only now, the patients come away with an understanding of the cost elements of their medical care. Doctors and other professionals have also described for us just how much time and money they spend on tax planning. Some spend tens of thousands of dollars setting up legal tax avoidance schemes and then pay thousands of dollars each year in maintenance costs. Many of them see the fair tax as an opportunity to decrease the payments they seek from their patients and their clients without affecting their personal incomes. And the record keeping involved shouldn't be much worse than the income and payroll tax reports they already have to prepare. Under the fair tax, they simply need to keep track of their business-to-business purchases and the amount of gross sales and the tax collected. That's it. And they won't even be paying these taxes. Their patients will. We didn't make the decision to tax services capriciously. We believe, as a matter of principle, that government shouldn't pick winners and losers. We have no right to decide that those who are making a living selling goods should put out the time and effort to collect revenues for the government, while those who sell services can just sit back and enjoy it. Under the current tax system, both these elements of our economy carry the burden of embedded taxes, both of them. The fair tax should not completely untax one sector, the service sector, while taxing the other. Today, personal consumption of services constitutes nearly 60% of national personal consumption and 42% of the economy. Compare this to 1950, when services only accounted for about a third of personal consumption and 22% of our economy. In the book, you'll find a graph that shows how the services portion of expenditures has climbed steadily and the goods portion has fallen since 1950. Of course, all of this raises the question of internet commerce. Just as we believe that services should be taxed, we propose that a procedure should be set up in the Treasury Department to collect taxes on internet and catalog sales, remitting the state and local government share to them. You may not be aware of this, but it is perfectly legal to tax internet sales today at the state level. For practical reasons, however, this is done by only the largest companies. State governments lost $23 billion in tax collections on internet sales in 2001. That number is growing dramatically each year. By 2008, estimated to be almost $34 billion. Okay, we understand you like your internet to be a tax-free zone. The idea of taxing internet sales probably has you ready to throw this audiobook across the room. Remember, though, the fair tax isn't about picking economic winners and losers. Fairness means that all commerce is treated equally. We're not looking for new ways to tax, but it isn't fair to put our neighbors who build a building to sell books in our community and who hire our kids and participate in our community and vote in our elections and attend our places of worship a 23% disadvantage over somebody with an internet store. Nevertheless, the fact that so many states with sales taxes exempt services from collecting those taxes makes this seem like a big step for service providers and consumers alike. We agree that it's an important step, of course, but we'd like to demonstrate that it won't be difficult to do so. While a tax on your doctor's services may seem unusual to many of you, a state sales tax on other services is not. A Federation of Tax Administrators survey found out that on the average, 55 of 164 service categories are taxed at the state level, with businesses and other services the most frequently taxed, and computer and professional services the least taxed. Hawaii and New Mexico have broad-based sales taxes that include almost all services, 160 for Hawaii, 156 for New Mexico. In fact, the survey found that five states already tax half or more of the 164 identified service categories. So while most states' taxes have lagged behind the general trend of the U.S. economy moving away from goods production and toward higher-value service production, the experience of the more forward-looking states shows us that change is not only possible, but it's available today. Whoa, you might say, what about that disaster in Florida a few years back when they tried to institute a tax on services? Well, that's a good question, particularly for folks who just read the headlines. It's true that Florida faced an uprising from doctors, dentists, lawyers, and other service providers when they imposed a tax on services, so much so that it ultimately had to repeal the tax. But the lesson of the Florida experience isn't that taxes on services won't work, it's that uniformity is the key. You see, beyond the simple service taxes, Florida also tried something no other state ever has. They tried to impose a tax on media outlets for the value of media services, advertising, they provided in Florida. Confused? Well, so were the media outlets. Here's how it was supposed to work. Let's say McDonald's comes out with a new all-beef patty and special goo campaign it wants to release nationwide. Under this short-lived Florida plan, Florida would have taxed McDonald's on the share of that campaign that came into Florida. How would that have been calculated? Well, McDonald's would have needed to get in touch with all of the print, radio, and TV outlets in Florida, determine how many people viewed the ad, and pay a tax on that. Good grief. And they say the fair tax is crazy. No wonder the Florida service tax was repealed. But let's peel the onion back a layer or two. First, Florida was trying to impose a tax on advertising in Florida on businesses that weren't based in Florida. That's like trying to impose a Florida sales tax on goods purchased by Floridians but sold by internet companies from across the nation. It's hard to do, and it places a special burden on the company to come up with a Florida solution. Second, Florida placed the sales tax on business-to-business transactions as well as consumer sales. Now think back to our embedded taxes in a loaf of bread example. Florida was imposing a tax on every one of those service steps, and then again on the final sale. Think about how many additional transactions would have had to be monitored and how all of those taxes would have cascaded through all of those layers to the final consumer. Finally, both of those missteps hit the advertising and media industries. Now let's think about it. Do the advertising and media industries have any special tools at their disposal for influencing public opinion? Yep, and that means the Florida services tax never had a chance. The fair tax is completely different. It is a uniform national tax, making collection simple and easy. It replaces other burdensome taxes rather than adding an additional layer of unpleasantness or an additional cost. The fair tax does not tax business-to-business transactions. All those dozens of steps involved in making bread are exempt. Only the final sale to the consumer is taxed, and it doesn't pick winners and losers. It applies to absolutely all consumer purchases, so no one industry will feel advantaged or disadvantaged. This is just yet another example of the importance of distinguishing between a sales tax and the fair tax. Have there been examples of disastrous state sales taxes? Absolutely. Have the researchers behind the fair tax learned from those disasters and created thoughtful solutions? You can count on it. Next criticism. The fair tax keeps the rate low by taxing government consumption, but taxing government consumption doesn't make sense and it won't work. I love this one. The fair tax treats all governments, federal, state, and local, as individual consumers. Under the plan, all government purchases of labor, supplies, or services would be subject to the fair tax. Why would you tax the government? How about just for revenge? But for this one, let's turn to the President's Advisory Panel on Tax Reform, which considered the same question during its consideration of the value-added tax, another consumption tax. The panel came to the same conclusion that we did. The rationale for this treatment is to prevent federal, state, or local governments from having an advantage over the private sector in areas where the two might compete to supply similar products. Now, doesn't that sound like a worthy goal to you? Why would we want to use tax policy to give the government a leg up on the private sector? The reason behind this provision is entirely a matter of principle. Governments shouldn't use the taxes paid in by taxpayers to compete against the taxpayers who support them. Many states, for instance, have prison industries, which raise money by selling cleaning chemicals to other government offices. They take the taxes paid by the private chemical manufacturers to feed and house the prison population, which then works for them at virtually no cost and then competes against the very companies that pay the taxes. That's subsidizing the competition, folks. By the same token, many cities sell electricity or natural gas to their citizens. They go to the voters bragging about how they are keeping property taxes low because they make a profit on those services. But they do so because they're being subsidized by the property taxes taken from the businesses they compete with, and they pass statutes that outlaw competition. In Georgia, a federally owned organization called the Southeastern Power Authority provides electricity to a large swath of citizens in eastern Georgia. During the 1995 Republican takeover in Washington, a proposal was put forth to auction this facility off to the private sector. The uproar from the citizens and some of the representatives was huge. It became clear to many that if a private electricity provider owned the facility, electricity rates would move to competitive market rates. If that happened, the rates would rise. It took no time at all to understand this arrangement. The rates were being subsidized by the taxpayers. If you begin with the common, entirely rational assumption, as we do, that no government can provide goods and services to anybody as efficiently as a private business, why not encourage governments to get out of the competitive marketplace for any services not uniquely the province of government? It's easy to see, as the President's tax panel did, the huge competitive advantages that governments would have over the private sector if they were exempt from paying the fair tax. By taxing government's purchases of labor and supplies, we limit the competitive advantage that it has over private business, the very businesses that create the wealth from which governments derive taxes. Now, is this going to increase the cost of government? Let's explore that question. First, governments at all levels already pay taxes. The income and payroll taxes that government deducts from the checks of government employees plus the employer's portion of the payroll tax, they're all remitted to the federal government out of government coffers. The same embedded taxes that exist today in the goods and services you buy at the retail level are present in the cost of goods and services purchased by governments. Just as with personal consumption, the equilibrium between increased take-home pay and reduced prices from eliminating embedded tax costs would insulate governments from increased cost. If the prices go down, the spending side of the government ledger benefits. If the prices don't go down because take-home pay goes up instead, the revenue side of the government ledger would benefit from the increased consumer spending. One more thing. Who would benefit from government paying the fair tax? Who gets the money? The government. So just what is the big problem here? Next criticism. I've seen conflicting claims. Will the fair tax drive prices up or down? Well, here's a claim that has taken on mythical proportion in the anti-fair tax literature. Quote, when the 22% embedded cost of the IRS is driven out of the price system and replaced by a 23% sales tax, your cost of living will go up about 1%, but you'll get to keep your whole check. The average income earner will get about a 50% increase in take-home pay that more than makes up for the 1% increase in cost, unquote. Well, you've seen this sentiment before. We took it on earlier in Myths About the Fair Tax. But now that we're into the real meat of the book, let's go after it one more time. Can everything in the statement above be true? No, not at the same time, not in the first year of the fair tax. As we often note, the payroll tax and the personal income tax withholding account for much of the embedded cost of the IRS. If abolished by the fair tax, these two taxes could not be retained by the employer to reduce the cost of the product and be given to the employee to increase his take-home pay. You'll be using the same dollars twice. But can we even be sure that those dollars would be used for some combination of reducing the cost of the product or increasing your pay? Absolutely. Competition will guarantee it. And the result is that America's standard of living will stay roughly the same, even though America will be seeing the full and true cost of its tax system for the very first time. Here's what's likely to happen. Most employers will give their employees a gross check that includes the dollars that used to be withheld for income and payroll taxes. As Alan Greenspan told us, wages are sticky things. People who have agreed to work for a given pay will expect to earn that pay. Depending on the employment rate and the availability of a competent workforce, some employers will give their workers the portion of the payroll tax the company pays on the employee's behalf. After all, that too is part of the cost of that person's employment. Most will try not to do that, and the result is going to depend on the workforce. What about the reduction in the cost of goods and services? For the sake of argument, let's assume the worst, that at first every company is going to try to keep prices at the current level and increase their profits. As we've discussed, they'll never succeed. Competition will drive those costs out of the system. If the company tries to keep the portion of the payroll tax that it pays on behalf of employees, that cost will be driven out of the price of the product or service. It's important to note that the 22% cost of the IRS that's embedded in the price system we're talking about doesn't include the cost of complying with the code. There are entire floors of some companies' offices occupied by tax specialists. Some companies have entire floors occupied by IRS employees year-round. The billions of dollars that go to pay for those specialists, including the billions spent on just calculating the tax implications of a business decision, will quickly come out of the pricing system. Now, for most workers, whose average withholding is 25% for income taxes and about 8% for payroll taxes, there will be a substantial increase in take-home pay. When you add the prebate to this increase in take-home pay, everybody is going to benefit from an increase in purchasing power, and that's just in year one. Over the long term, the worker's pocket will grow even fuller, regardless of what happens to prices. For example, one macroeconomic study of the fair tax, a study that assumed that the employer's share of the payroll tax is the only tax savings that will be used to lower prices, estimated that prices would rise by 24.8%, but wages would rise by 27.4%, more than compensating for the increase in prices. By these calculations, disposable income is expected to increase by 1.7%. And of course, it's important to remember that you'll be paying the fair tax only on whatever portion of your income you decide to spend. investments and savings will escape the fair tax. It's critically important to understand a study like this one because the anti-fair tax lobby is always arguing that the fair tax is going to raise prices by almost 25%. That sounds scary. And actually, this study agrees with them. But it's only scary until you look again and realize that workers' paychecks are being increased by an even greater amount. And remember, this is a worst-case scenario. You can see how easy it is to disprove the merits of the fair tax using this study. If you hear some politicians saying that the fair tax will raise taxes by more than 20%, what's the average listener likely to do? Question his math or go home trembling in horror at the prospect of paying that much more money on every trip to the store? Of course, the demagogue will somehow forget to cover two important details, the prebate and the fact that your personal income will increase more than the prices. Remember that 1.7% increase in year one? By year 10, this study suggests that disposable income may be almost 12% higher for working Americans than it would have been under the current tax system. So you see, even the most alarming economic studies of the fair tax still paint a winning picture for American wage earners. What do we have to lose here? Studies like this lead us to conclude that it truly doesn't matter whether prices rise or wages fall, or if some combination of the two occurs. In every case, American workers would have more purchasing power in the domestic marketplace in a fair tax world than they do in today's tax world. The next criticism, tax evasion under the fair tax will cripple our economy. Okay, first of all, let's admit it. Even with the fair tax, there is going to be cheating. We're Americans, and we love to try to cheat on our taxes. But will tax cheating be any worse under the fair tax than it is today? We don't think so. We've been told from the beginning that a tax rate as high as 23% will cause huge evasion problems. We hear it most often from people in the Treasury Department who will go to any extreme to prevent a change in the current system. Is it any surprise that people who owe their very jobs to the complexity of our present tax system fight simplification? Remember, even if they should leave the government, many of these people may be expecting to spend the rest of their lives as lobbyists gaming the current system. So let's look at the state of tax cheating under the current system. In 2001, the last year for which we had good information, the IRS reported that it collected $345 billion less than it was owed, about 16% of all that was owed. That is known as the tax gap. The IRS is always quick to produce statistics detailing the shortfall in the collection of income taxes. It doesn't seem quite so eager to estimate the shortfall in tax payments from income earned by the underground economy. We're told they just can't figure out a way to come up with such an estimate. Are you following us here? The IRS, in other words, is happy to let us know how much money it's losing to those who cheat on their tax returns, but they'd prefer not to talk about how much they're losing to the underground economy. One of the ingenious byproducts of the fair tax is that participants in the underground economy can't escape it. They may rake in millions of dollars through gambling and drugs or other illegal activities. They may create some very impressive bank accounts with the money they've made off the books. But when they go out to spend those dollars, whether it's on jewelry, Jaguars, or junk food, they're going to pay the fair tax. Might we suggest that when you combine the tax gap, which the IRS does estimate, with the lost tax revenue from the underground economy, which the IRS doesn't estimate, the total lost tax revenue dwarfs any realistic estimate of cheating under the fair tax? There's another point to be made. Cheating under the fair tax would be more difficult than cheating on an income tax return. And why? Because with the fair tax, it takes two to cheat. It's not that difficult to lie on your tax return. You just enter a false figure, you sign, you file. You don't have to tell anybody, not even your spouse. Your risk of being audited, less than 1%. With the fair tax, on the other hand, you need two people, a seller and a purchaser, to conspire to cheat, and each of them is risking jail to do so. We don't know how many of your friends would be willing to risk jail to save you 23 cents on a dollar, but we don't have any friends like that. And when you look at who'll be collecting the tax, the chances of drumming up a conspiracy suddenly look even worse. In America, 0.03% of all of America's companies, that's 688 companies to be exact, sell 48.5% of all of the stuff. Those companies aren't going to help you cheat. There's too much at stake. Data also shows that 3.6% of all of America's companies, 92,334 firms, collectively make 85.7% of all sales. They aren't going to help you cheat either. It's even more important for the owners of these companies to stay in business and out of jail than it is to help you to avoid paying the fair tax. What about services? Isn't this where the cheating is going to occur? Is the lawn guy really going to pay 23% to the feds? When it comes to the services sector, the fact is that 1.2% of all businesses make approximately 80% of the sales in the service sector. They, too, have too much to lose to risk helping you cheat. Even if the fair tax were paid only by those few companies, we would still have a better collection rate than the IRS currently has under the income tax. Of the remaining 96% of the retail companies, nearly 99% of the service companies, most will be honest and collect the tax. Some, of course, will not. The fact remains that the collection rate for the fair tax will be better than the collection rate for the income tax. Add to this the fact that we're also collecting the fair tax from the underground economy and from illegal aliens, taxes that aren't even anticipated or quantified by the current tax regime, and you can see how the numbers stack up. So where will the cheating come from? Since the biggest problem in collections in the income tax regime comes from sole proprietors, we would guess the same business sector will creatively try to avoid the fair tax. The guy who comes to fix your roof may collect the tax from you, but not remit it. But the vast majority of small businesses, the ones with business licenses to protect, will collect and remit the fair tax so they don't lose their license or go to jail. We believe the numbers for compliance and avoidance dramatically favor the fair tax. So there it is. Most of the fair tax money will be collected by big companies that have no interest in cheating, and the lower marginal rates will mean that small companies will have less interest in cheating. And there's one more biggie, and that's enforcement. The fair tax takes current individual taxpayers out of the tax collection and payment business altogether. Just how many people would that be? About 165 million. That's 165 million people who are at present needing to be watched closely and perhaps audited by the IRS to ensure compliance. With the fair tax, we'll have about 25 million businesses to watch instead of 165 million taxpayers. Suddenly, the challenges of enforcement are starting to look a lot easier, aren't they? Further, the states and the feds, at least in the 45 states that have sales taxes, will all be looking at the same companies. Maybe we're just too straight and narrow. But it seems to us that the idea of cheating under the fair tax is more like a red herring than a real problem. Criticism. The prebate is a giant government handout. It would be better just to exempt things like groceries and medical care. Sorry, that one doesn't hold water either. Many people have approached us with the argument that we should do away with the prebate and simply exempt necessities from the fair tax. They dismiss the prebate as very expensive to administer, as the largest entitlement ever passed, and we can understand why many people don't like the idea of every household in the U.S. getting a monthly check from the government. We don't really like the sound of that either. But is the prebate a handout? No, hardly. We start with the assumption that every household is going to spend what it needs to every month to provide for the basic necessities. We believe that the government should acknowledge and honor the need of every household, rich or poor, to cover the cost of its basic needs before it starts funding the government. The fair tax prebate would no more be a welfare program than are the standard deduction and personal exemptions we have under the current income tax system. To disagree with this approach is to believe that the government should have the first claim on household income, a claim superior to the household's need to provide for its own sustenance. That's an America none of us wants. The critics of the prebate somehow never seem to mention that the current income tax system doles out about $456 billion more to favored taxpayers than the fair tax prebate would. The fair tax prebate is an advance rebate of taxes that would be paid on spending up to the poverty level based on family size. The cumulative prebate is estimated by the Beacon Hill Institute of Suffolk University in Boston to be $489 billion per year. That is assuming 100% participation. Now compare that to the $945 billion cost of income tax deductions, tax preferences, loopholes, credits, and favors that we have under the current tax system. Would you really prefer to keep the almost $1 trillion cost of today's convoluted system in place while rejecting a prebate that would cost half as much and would treat all Americans equally? Does that sound like a good move to you? How would it be administered, you ask? Wouldn't that make for an unmanageable amount of paperwork? No, not at all. For one thing, we don't envision the prebate even being a check. The federal government has been moving toward electronic transfers for years. For example, right now, more than 99% of all federal salary payments, 83% of all Social Security payments are made by electronic transfer directly into the recipient's bank account. Electronic transfers save the government 80 cents per recipient compared to the cost of sending a check. Issuing a paper check costs the federal government 89 cents. An electronic transfer costs about one-tenth of that amount, and it occurs almost instantaneously. The prebate could be distributed to millions of households with a little more than a click of a mouse. The prebate could also be distributed through a debit card provided to each qualified household. Each month, the amount of that family's prebate would be electronically transferred to the card. A 1996 federal law required that paper food stamps be converted to an electronic format. Today, all 50 states use electronic cards to distribute 99.8% of all food stamp benefits. Now, interestingly enough, some major credit card companies have expressed an interest in setting up a system whereby they would administer part of the fair tax prebate for their credit card holders. The government would transfer the funds to the credit card company every month, and on the first day of that month, the appropriate prebate would be credited to the cardholder's account. What's more, these credit card companies have even talked about the idea of paying the federal government a fee for the privilege of handling these prebates. What about the argument that exempting groceries and health care would be easier and fairer? One member of Congress has suggested that we identify certain products for exemption, that we should exclude potatoes, for example, but not potato chips. We agree with him that potatoes are better for you than potato chips, but this fellow missed one of the main points of the fair tax. Chips, French fries, mashed potatoes, it's your choice. The government has no role in that decision. The government's role should be limited to collecting taxes to raise needed revenue, not controlling our lifestyle choices. Furthermore, providing tax relief through the prebate makes the administration of the tax much more efficient and keeps compliance costs at a minimum for retailers and service providers. The greatest complaint businesses have about state sales taxes is how complex all the exemptions are and how costly it is to administer them. Exclusions and exemptions? Isn't that what's made our current system such a chaotic mess? Politicians have been picking winners and losers for decades. You favor certain activities or interests with tax deductions and credits. Let the consumers pick the winners and losers. Government needs to butt out. Here's another point for those of you who would scrap the prebate for a hideously complicated system of exclusions and exemptions. Personal consumption of food represents about a sixth of the economy. Healthcare and services represent another sixth. To exempt them would take about a third of the economy off the table, and the ultimate tax rate would be too high to be practicable. Exempting necessities would also give the lobbyist a new job. They would be hired by every interest group in the country to convince Congress that their interest group is clearly essential and should be exempted from the fair tax. And once that dam breaks, the fair tax just wouldn't work. It's clear, even without those millions of dollars worth of research, that the prebate is the best method for untaxing every household right up to the poverty level. Fair and simple. Isn't it about time we had that in a tax code? Okay, our next criticism. Just repealing and replacing the income tax code seems difficult enough. Isn't the fair tax overreaching by going after payroll tax too? Fair tax aside, something has to be done about the current income tax. Any fair analysis of what the income tax has become will show that at the very least, it's a threat to economic liberty, and at the worst, it is a threat to our republic. By no rational set of criteria could the current income tax be described as anything approximating fair. We have a chart in the book. In that chart, you will see that 40% of our population is actually on the take. The bottom 50% of all income earners pay 3.4% of the income taxes collected. In 1986, that figure was 6.7%. The trend is going in the wrong direction. We're moving steadily to a situation where the majority of income earners in this country, or the majority of voters, however you want to label it, will be paying no income tax whatsoever. This is a trend that has been nurtured by Democrats and Republicans alike. In the book, you'll see a chart on who pays the federal income tax. This chart was created by us using data from the Congressional Budget Office. It represents the percentage of the total federal income tax burden paid by each of the income classes shown on the chart. If you get a copy of the book and look at that chart, it should be enough to convince you. Do you see where we're going? We've already reached the point where the overwhelming majority of taxes are paid by a small minority of the taxpayers. How long is it going to be before we get to the point where the majority pay no income taxes at all? How will the majority react when the political candidate tells them, "Vote for my opponent and he'll make you pay income taxes"? There's a quote that has been most commonly attributed to Alexander Fraser Titler, or Titler. He has so many names we can't keep track of them, even in a lengthy footnote. It's in a book, The Decline and Fall of the Athenian Republic. The quote is this: "A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover that they can vote themselves generous benefits from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidate promising them the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy, always followed by a dictatorship." Now, does that sound familiar? Benjamin Franklin is said to have sounded the same alarm. He said, "When the people find out they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic." We don't take these warnings lightly. But solving the problem above by reforming or replacing only the income tax and ignoring payroll taxes will translate into a huge tax increase on the bottom 40% of income earners. Most reformers give up their pursuit at this point. What we're saying here is that Americans have a troubling tendency to focus on the income tax. When was the last time you were sitting around the dinner table and the topic of payroll taxes came up? Well, shame on you, shame on us all, because the payroll tax is the largest tax most of us pay. In fact, and read this carefully, or I should say, listen to me, the payroll tax brings in almost as much money every year as the personal income tax does. In 2004, the payroll tax actually raised more money for the federal government than the personal income tax did. So why do Americans spend so much time talking about the income tax and so little time talking about the payroll tax? Keep this question in front of your mind as we approach some additional criticisms of the fair tax. Most of these criticisms compare the fair tax, or any garden variety sales tax, to the income tax, and then proceed to hastily draw conclusions. Well, the fair tax is not a garden variety sales tax. If you're going to compare the fair tax to anything, you must compare it to both the income tax and the payroll tax. The fair tax would abolish and replace both. While we're at it, you should also throw in the corporate income tax, which would also be replaced by the fair tax. What difference does it make? A huge difference. Because one of the most common and talked about ways to look at the tax code is through a single year distributional analysis. Now, we don't think that's the best way to view a code, and many scholars and economists agree with us, but we'll put that aside for now. We have a chart in the book, a single year distributional analysis of the personal income tax, the tax everybody talks about, writes about, and worries about. What would a chart of the payroll tax look like? Well, that chart also is in the book, and it shows the payroll tax is still progressive. Those who earn more pay more, but you don't see the negative numbers at the lower levels that you do with the income tax. You don't see the incredibly high numbers for the high income levels as you do with the income tax. This is important, since the payroll tax takes almost as much money from Americans as the income tax does. And since most of us pay more in payroll taxes than we do in income taxes, when it comes time to ask, how will the fair tax affect my pocketbook, the fact that the fair tax would abolish both the income tax and the payroll tax becomes critically important. So in logistical terms, would it be easier just to reform the income tax? Probably. That's been tried before with other consumption tax plans. But real reform, real change, is impossible in the context of the income tax alone. And since the payroll tax is just as heavy a burden as the income tax, it doesn't make economic sense to try to solve one without addressing the other. By reforming both, the fair tax captures the maximum amount of economic energy for growth and minimum disruption of our current tax distribution tables. If you want to dispute those tables, fine. But don't count on the fair tax to help. The next criticism, the fair tax will cripple the housing industry by eliminating the home mortgage interest deduction and placing the fair tax on new home purchases. Okay. Oh boy, let's first deal with the argument about the home mortgage interest deduction. There's a very respected syndicated talk show host on the West Coast who is often asked by his callers if he supports the fair tax. He answers that he does not because it would take away the mortgage interest deduction. I think we talked about him earlier in this book. Virtually every time he says this on his program, we get anguished emails from listeners begging for us to contact this talk show host and set him straight on the mortgage interest issue. Well, this is both good news and bad news. The bad news is that there is a widely respected talk show host who, quite frankly, doesn't have a clue in the world of what he's talking about. The good news is thousands of listeners recognize that. Now, we can cut to the chase by asking you a couple of questions. First question. Would the home mortgage interest deduction be of any value to you if you didn't owe any income taxes? Now, if you answered yes to this, go ahead and stop the CD or the tape right now. We can be of no further help to you. Then again, you could hang in here for some more education. You certainly need it. Second question. If you walked into a grocery store with a coupon for 25% off bread, would you be angry if you found out that they were giving bread away that day and your coupon was worthless? You see what we're driving at? The home mortgage interest deduction is meaningless if you don't pay income taxes. You may be surprised to learn that about 70% of households that pay income taxes don't take advantage of the home mortgage interest deduction anyway. the deduction means nothing to them because they don't itemize the deductions on their tax returns. Now, I like to put it to you this way, and I mentioned this earlier in this taped book. If somebody says to you, and you're a Fair Tax supporter, what about the home mortgage interest deduction? Just look at them, put your hand on their shoulder, say, hey, Sam, tell you what, you can keep yours. What? Go ahead and keep your home mortgage interest deduction. If it makes you feel any better, you can keep it. In fact, we'll let you deduct the principal and the interest on your home mortgage loan from your income tax. You will? And then you sit there and just kind of look at him. If he has any sense at all, slowly it's going to dawn on him. Proponents of the home mortgage interest deduction like to claim that it exists to help the middle class own homes, but they rarely provide the data on who really benefits from the $69.4 billion tax deduction. Remember the mortgage deduction example when we were talking about earmarks earlier? A close look reveals that little of that benefit goes to low and middle income families. According to IRS data, more than half of the taxpayers claiming the deduction earn less than $30,000, but they collectively receive less than 10% of the total mortgage interest deduction. Likewise, the 71% of filers with incomes less than $50,000 received only a quarter of the total tax deduction. Maybe this home mortgage interest deduction isn't the middle class savior some people claim it is. This one